at where the wires come in on either side, what I do is use this, what they call it, RTV sealant. You know, I guess you've seen that, that smells like vinegar when you first put it on. I use a little RTV sealant. Now, in the middle of the jar, on the top end of the jar, if you want a hook, you can put a hook there also, you know, if you want to hang it from the center, Dick. I've done that a couple of times where I've put a hook with a big washer inside, you know, with a screw nut type, to clamp it with two washer inside and outside, you know, an eye hook type of setup. But once the jar is closed like that, you don't have any problems with any kind of corrosion or anything getting into that jar. That lid closes pretty close, pretty tight, over.
B2FYJ comment.
Harry recognized. I am guessing that the real tension of the dipole itself is being held by the plastic plexiglass center device inside the jar. By the same token, I think your hook should connect to that piece of plexiglass, not just to the outer plastic of the peanut butter jar, because I think you could rip it out. Let's see how Harry solves the problem. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, I never had to put up a dipole right near the ocean, so I never really thought about it much until this discussion. But it occurs to me that the peanut butter jar method that Mel is describing will work fine, except that it's very, very lightweight. Something that occurs to me that might serve in a more robust environment and also allow easier access to the center feed point if you needed to get to it would be to take a Pelican box, which is designed for making a waterproof seal. You drill a cup, three holes, one on each of three sides, so that you can feed the wires through, put a rubber grommet on it in each of the holes, and then seal them up with silicone caulking. And then you have a nice watertight box that you can easily open. You could even put a balloon inside it, and it's much more rigorous and hardy container than those very, very thin peanut butter jars.
And these Pelican boxes, I think, are used for the purpose of electrical wiring in a house, but I'm not sure. And is Pelican a brand name, or is it just a popular type? And I'll bet they come in a zillion different sizes with a rubber gasket on that cover that's held down with something like four screws. Is that true, Harry?
Well, the ones that I'm familiar with, first, Pelican is a brand name, and the ones that I'm familiar with are used for holding diving instruments and gear, and it's actually just a clamp. I don't know how you describe it, a lever clamp. You have two lever clamps that hold the top down. The one that I have, I keep my paper documentation in when I go diving so that it stays bone dry. I've seen them in several sizes, and the one that I have happens to be about, so I guess, 6 or 8 inches by 5 or 6 inches by about 3 inches deep. But they do come in all manner of sizes. I've also seen them fairly large for putting photographic equipment in. As I say, it is a brand name, and they're just those lever clamps. You know, the wire goes around the hook, and then you push the lever down, and it pulls it tight.
Are these also sold by Lowe's and Home Depot and places like that?
I don't really know. They might be. As a matter of fact, I'm about to go online and see what the current status is for them. It's conceivable that they're not even being made anymore. It's been a while since I had to buy one, but they were a very, very fine box. Give me 2 minutes and I'll tell you what the current status is on them.
RSO with info.
Go ahead, Frank.
I believe B&H Photo sells them specifically designed for professional photo equipment, cameras, lights. The Pelican brand covers a multitude of hobbies. They're available. They're watertight. almost crash-proof containers, and quite expensive, and they're available for just about anything that you want to protect. I believe some of them can also be purchased with a way of suctioning the air out and making them a preservative type of container. Back to you and to RSO.
Hi, Jay. More info.
Go ahead, Harry. Thank you, Frank. Go ahead, Harry.
At www.pelican.com, they're definitely still around, and they've got a huge line of stuff. Let's see. Memory card cases, camera cases, underwater flashlight cases, specialty boxes, all sorts of stuff. They've got dealers all over the place. If you go to their website, there's a list of U.S. dealer locations. And I think you can order directly from them online also. www.pelican.com, P-E-L-I-C-A-N.
You know, when people talk about www, I'm tempted to call it Hex U, six U's. And they sell it. Nice, rugged, weatherproof boxes. So there's hardware out there that can do it, Mel. K2KEY. Do you put that solid piece of plexiglass or a real strain insulator in the center, and your hook, I think, should grab onto that, not onto the peanut butter jar itself. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, I guess you could do that. I haven't had any problems. I put a big washer inside there, you know. So, and it's clamped to put another washer on the outside. Usually, I use one of those with the 1/4-20. I think they call 1/4-20 thread. So I got the nut and two nuts, you know, clamping between with two washers, and the plexiglass inside there, you know, the cable and everything is ported on. Is actually hanging on a piece of 1/4-inch thick plexiglass there. The dipoles, when they come in there, you know, just loop one time around, tie it around one time, you know, twist it around once, you know, through the hole, and so that you're not tearing at the jar. I haven't had any jars that need to come apart yet. I've got a couple of them here because somebody asked me. I showed them. In fact, the other day somebody was visiting, and I showed him, you know, you can't even see these dipoles like I have in the trees and all. And when he saw it, he says, what is that? He says, is that a jar up there? I says, yeah, that's a peanut butter jar with a red cover. And you can see the balum inside of it, you know, with a piece of, you know, the whole business and all. Well, let me put it this way, Dick. It's cheap, and I'm a cheap ham, over.
Do you use Skippy brand of peanut butter? And some of them, don't they come in glass jars, Mel? Go ahead.
Now you can't get peanut butter no more. It's all in plastic jars. Yeah, Skippy or the other Jif. Yeah, eat any of them. They're the same jar. Look like they're made by the same company or some goddamn thing. But there's a lot of plastic jars around. And when you tighten the cap on, you know, because they had that good hermetic seal or whatever they call that for, you know, keeping freshness. You'd be amazed. I have not had one yet where anything has taken place inside the jar. And the connections, everything is beautifully clean. Everything stays clean. And because of the strain relief in them there, you know, the way it's held, in other words, you don't have the risk of the coax coming and being held by the connector. Usually your coax is hanging by the connector over there, you know, and so even you bring the insulation sometimes as tight as you can into the connector by threading the insulation into the connector. In other words, I've got a tool that puts like a thread into the polyethylene jacket of the cable, so that when you screw it into the PL259 connector, it's supposed to give it extra strain stick for, you know, before you solder it over.
Is that some kind of a dye-like thing that makes threads? Where did you get that, Mel? Go ahead.
Tell you, I made it. I took a piece of piece of aluminum stock, round stock. I have, you know what it is? I once picked up the tap to clean up the thread. You know, you look at a PL-259, it has a thread in the back there. You can force the cable in as best you can. You try to force it. And I said, I can't. Why am I forcing? If this thing, if I had a die that could cut threads into the jacket of a piece of coax cable, you know, I could then screw it into the back of the connector. And, you know, if you do it, I made this thing up. What I did is I turned down a piece of aluminum. I drilled it out, and then I put the tap in. So now I had a die. And what I do is I put it on the jacket. I put a number of threads on the jacket. Now you screw it into the PL-259, and I'll tell you something. You can't pull it off just by screwing it in and before you solder it, over.
Go ahead, Harry.
This isn't Harry. This is Tim, N2RDB. I have a question.
Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to say I've been listening regularly to the TechNet, and just what a wonderful job you guys are doing there for such a long time. My question is, are you pre-tinning the braid before screwing it onto this into this die?
I'm going to pass it over to Mel to find out what he does, but I pre-tin the braid, and my motivation for doing that is so that there's no extra strands hanging around that can create a short circuit between the shield and the center conductor. Also, when you then solder through the four holes of the PL-259, when the braid is pre-tinned, it takes a lot less heat and time, so you don't end up melting the polyethylene or foam or whatever the material is. So I do pre-tin the braid. Let's see what Mel does. You got it, Mel.
I sure do. Now, okay, the procedure is, first of all, I want to cut the jacket back. Now, a lot of people take a knife and cut the jacket back. What I bought is a little small pipe cutter that is used in the air conditioning industry for cutting tubing, you know, the copper tubing. There's a little pipe cutter. It's a very, very small one, a little wheel. What I do is I put that on there and just cut into the jacket. It makes a nice round cut into the jacket. And just pull it where it touches the braid. Now you slip the thing off. You got a nice square cut now. Now you also make your measurements. You know, you're gonna solder up the braid now and measure it off. And now I cut the braid after it's soldered, after I pinned it up. I take the same cutter, this little pipe cutter, and now I cut the braid through the braid with this pipe cutter device. So I go through the braid to the center insulating material. Now with a razor, I just go around till I touch the center conductor. So now when you pull that off, the braid comes off with the insulation portion, leaving the center conductor nice and square. It's all square, everything, now, because you're using that cutter rather than eyeballing it with a knife. Now I pin the center up a little bit. I put on my die, and I cut in now to the... into the polyethylene jacket and put my thread on it, and now screw the whole business into the PL-259 and then do the finishing soldering. Dick, over.
That sounds like a nice, neat way of assembling. Yeah, properly putting on UG21 type N connectors or PL-259s is a bit of an art form, and to do it with all this mechanical strain relief and strengthening and whatever that you're describing, and with real soldering, in my opinion, is the best way to do it. There are people out there who just love crimp connectors. And if you're doing a quick job where you don't have to have super conductivity because you're not making jumpers for a duplexing filter, if you're putting on connectors indoors, maybe crimp connectors are okay. I, for one, do not trust crimp connectors outdoors. I wonder if that's some of the information you were looking for, Tim. K2RIW.
Thank you. I don't trust crimp connectors under any circumstances. I do actually work with electronics equipment on a daily basis, and you know, in my ham shack there are no crimp connectors. I don't believe in them. So, well, thank you very much. I'll be listening further. This is N2RDB.
FYJ comment.
Okay, Harry, recognize. When you put a crimp connector on the end of the cable, you save the 5 minutes that it takes to put on the connector by the old technique. But if you do a real good job of putting a connector on the end of the cable and properly weatherproof it and got the right kind of strength, I'm likely to use that piece of cable and that connector for 10 years outdoors. And the fact that you saved 5 minutes when you put on the crimp connector, to me, is a false economy. Go ahead, Harry.
I agree, and for outdoor use, I agree wholeheartedly. The one thing that I would take exception to with Tim's comment about never trusting crimp connectors anywhere, there's one crimp connector that I absolutely trust, and that's the Anderson Power Pole, assuming that you crimped it on with their crimping device. It makes a connection that's at least as good as a solder joint, if not better.
You want to say anything about that one, Tim? Go ahead.
Sure, okay. I stand corrected, but the Anderson Power Pole is usually handling DC power, not RF, so RF is a whole different animal, I know that much. But yeah, the power poles are good. I know some people that actually crimp and solder them. They kind of go the extra mile there, which I guess it couldn't hurt matters. N2RDB.
Isn't there some plastic on top that when you solder it, you end up melting that plastic? Back to you, Tim.
I have a couple here in my hand. There's like a little metal insert that you solder on, and that just kind of clicks into place after.
Dick, this crimping and soldering gets done on the metal tab long before it goes anywhere near the plastic. That's just the housing that you slide it into in order to make it mate properly with another one. But all of the construction work is done outside the plastic.
And is the soldering, is there any soldering that takes place before the connector is mated to the cable, or is the soldering done after the mating and crimping? Back to you, Harry.
Number one, you don't need to solder, but if you choose to solder, you would crimp the connector onto the wire, and then you would heat it up and flow solder into it. And then after it cools, then you'd slide it into the plastic connector. And once it's in the plastic connector, you take two of them that are appropriately manufactured, and they just slide into each other, and your connection is made. Once they're assembled, there's no soldering involved whatsoever. But any soldering that you did do would be after you crimped and before you put it into the cover. If you're not familiar with them, I would recommend them highly for DC wiring and standardizing your wiring out of your power supply and into all of your equipment. They are really marvelous devices. And they come in all manner of sizes and amperage carrying capability.
G4, GFT.
GFT, go ahead.
Dick, morning, Bell. KB4, GFT over in Greenwich, Connecticut. Actually, Glenville. Previous KB1 OQD here. Volunteer firefighter over here in Glenville. We talked to you about a year and a half ago before we actually dropped off. And, we're back up. About the power pole connectors, I know quite a few guys up this way use them. West Mountain Radio up here in Norwalk, Connecticut, one of them sells them there. I believe they carry a lot of stuff in the rig runner and the rig blasters they use them on. But I've known guys that use those instead of great connectors, and they actually turned around and took shrink heat tubing there and laid them over that and shrunk the heat tubing over there to make a better seal and connection on them.
Sounds like a good way to go. Bob, in your QRZ.com picture of your gold-colored Jeep, what is that white fence-like material that's on top of the Jeep? Go ahead.
White fence. I got a light bar on top of it. I got a full-size welding light bar. Is that what you're talking about?
I see the light bar, but what is that other white object that's on the behind the light bar, but above the roof of that Jeep? What is that material?
Give me a minute, Victor. I'm on the website right now. And let me see what the... my laptop keyboard don't work, but I got another keyboard hooked up to it. Typing different types of letters there. I don't know. I'll have to look to see what we're talking about there. Give me a second.
Is your license plate 774RMX? And it says fire police?
Correct. Okay, if you blow up the picture, you can see it's my neighbor's fence there. It's a white picket fence there. If you click on the picture, it'll blow it up.
Okay, so that's the neighbor's picket fence in the background. It's not really above the Jeep. Is that, I'm making a misinterpretation?
That is correct.
Yeah, at first it looked like it was on top of the Jeep. Very good. Okay, Mel, back to you for whatever you'd like to discuss next. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, yeah. As I said, putting and Dick really emphasized also, putting on the connector is a little bit of work, but if you do it right, it's better off to spend a little bit more time in putting on that connector correctly than buying any of these twist-ons. I know they became very popular. They have these twist-on connectors. You talk about crimp ones. They have even cheaper versions that you just twist it on. You cut it. They give you a little guide how to skin the cable up, you know, and cut the shield back and everything. And then you just twist it on. There's no soldering, no crimping. And those are completely worthless as far as I'm concerned. However, we used in the end when I was working years ago, still now I consider myself unsuccessfully retired, but when before that, we used to use in the industry BNC connectors that were crimped on because they used so many, you just couldn't sit there and do it by the old-fashioned method. I don't even know if they got old-fashioned BNC connectors available anymore, but we used a three-piece system as three different crimp system, Dick, and they never had any problems. Like, I don't know, we never used them out, you know, exposed to the weather conditions, of course. But I see now that the connectors that they're using on all the CATV and everything, and these boxes, these connectors outside in the street that come from the cable and all, these F connectors, they're just crimped on, Dick, and just screwed on, and there's nothing protects them over.
And I'm kind of amazed that they'll survive. I think they survived because the signal that the cable company is supplying usually is so strong that it's at the top of the dynamic range of the automatic gain control of your television receiver. So if water getting in that cable created 5 dB of extra loss on that drop connector that goes to your house, you'd never know it. I think they use connectors that don't corrode outside, but I see no evidence that they do any real weatherproofing on that F connector. Is that about the way you see it, Mel? K2RIW?
The cable runs up the backyard. It's like a strip. It's like a block that hangs off the cable, and it's got a bunch of terminals on it. And when they put the cable on, you know, to go to the house, the guy takes a piece of coax there with a connector on it and just screws it on. That's it. He just screws it right on. And lets it just loop it, you know, to the strain relief. And the rest of the connectors, in fact, they're open all the time. There's nothing on them. It's just, you could literally, looks like anybody can go up there and screw a connector on. I mean, there's no box, no nothing. And I see this all over. And the people have it. I looked at it in the driveway. They put a bracket up where it looks like a double female F connector, and they got the cable comes in to that point, you know, and they screw it on one side, then the piece that goes into the house, they put another F connector, screw it on to the other side, and this block just sits there on the wall, Vic. No protection whatsoever, over.
So I think you're saying the way the block sits on the wall with those extra connectors sitting there, water could pour in there, give them some extra loss, but because the signal is so strong, they don't worry about it. Is that approximately what's going on?
Assume, because even up on the cable that's hanging, you know, runs between the poles in the backyard here, the block where they attach it to. They got a bunch of open connectors on there. I would thought that would be a plug or something on it, you know, a blind plug or whatever. Nothing, just open. That's it. And I would assume after a period of time, that some corrosion, something set in there, so that when you would want to make contact to it, it would be something would be not so great. But everything just seems like is that signal can override maybe any kind of condition. I was dumbfounded when I saw that. I said, gee, that looks awful haphazard not to have any kind of enclosure on either end, Dick, over.
Is all the cable system in your neighborhood conventional coaxial RF cable and not very much of it fiber optic, or some of it fiber optic, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, they came along here a couple of weeks ago and they started putting fiber optic cables in. And right now, I don't know what happened with it, but it's just hanging loose. They left a big loop here. I got a pole in the backyard, and they left a big loop in it. They put that stringer up, that steel cable first, and then they pulled it along that, and then they left loops at each pole, and that's it. It's just hanging there. And above it is the original, just the, you know, the hard line cable, and with the tap blocks on it. And that's what most of the people here are using, that the regular conventional coax cable. There's some people using satellite dishes, but I'm amazed that the one with the coax cable, everything is just wide open, everything. I mean, the connectors that come and go into this thing, just doesn't seem to be anybody took any care of trying to wrap them with anything. I'm just purely amazed at that it works, over.
And as I see it, they can simply tolerate all the extra loss. The messenger cable, the steel cable that they installed, and now it's hanging up loops of fiber optics. Do you believe it is your coaxial cable company that is switching over to fiber, or do you believe it is a competing fiber company that's about to compete with the coaxial cable? What do you think is going on there, Mel? Go ahead.
Of course, you see it advertised all the time. It's constantly going back and forth, cable or fiber. You know, the telephone company, I guess, is pushing the Fios, and the other one is pushing cable. Who the heck is it? I forgot the name of it. Manhattan Cable, I think they are, or something. They keep sending me, you know, advertisements that, you know, making it, you know, 6 months at a reduced rate and things, and give you this and give you that. In other words, there are very few people around here that have a, I hate to say it, but it's still over the air, receiving pictures over the air or whatever, Dick. I'm sure I'm the only one on the block. It's just a big joke, over.
Yeah, I may be the only human being in my town that is using over-the-air broadcast television reception. And as soon as I get a little bit enthusiastic, I'm going to put a better rotatable antenna for UHF capability up on my tower. But everyone else is on satellite, fiber, or coax cable TV. I cannot find a operating television aerial on the chimney of a house anywhere in my town. And you probably can go driving up and down all of your streets, and you won't find one even in your town, is what I think you're telling me, Mel. Go ahead.
The only TV antennas you see here are all falling apart, you know, been abandoned, with elements missing and things like that still hanging on the chimney. And in fact, I had a neighbor about a month or so ago, one fell over with three antennas on one pole on the chimney, and it fell over and went around, and it was like hanging on his roof and across the alleyway, the driveway between onto his neighbor's roof there, and he was a nervous wreck. He said, Mel, who can take this down? I said, listen, when I got my pole, my extension pole, and I said, I'll just pull this thing down for you right in the middle of the driveway, and that was it. The rest of them, I think that's about it. Maybe there's one or more on the block that's ready to fall down. So you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody still using a over-the-air signal here, except for me. But I don't have a TV antenna. I got it in the attic, and I'm getting 37 channels, would you believe it, in the attic with a just a regular TV antenna that I put in the attic many years ago, and leave it space basically north, towards the Empire State Building, which is line of sight from out here on my roof. Definitely you can look right at the Empire State Building. There's nothing in the way that anything that blocks it. So I'm getting all those channels, so we're happy, because we're not big TV watchers here, over.
So you're getting everything from the Empire State Building. Are you also getting channel 50 from New Jersey? Go ahead.
So it's just concerned, you know, we get 2 through 13, all those, and then that 5-1, 5-2, 4-3, 4-1, you know, those, like channel 4, I think it's about 4-1, 2, 4-3, 4-4, and then it's 5-1, 2, or whatever, 7, 2, 3, and then also something comes on there, it's 25, I think, comes in, and then a number of other UHF channels that I don't have much interest in. Then there's one that comes on and shows you pictures of traffic. I don't know what that's all about, but it keeps showing you pictures of traffic in Times Square and pictures of traffic by the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't have any idea what the heck that's all about, over.
Yeah, that's the Brooklyn channel from 25.2. 25.1 is a PBS channel. 25.2 is the one that cycles through all of those places in New York City with cameras. And the one it dwells on the longest period of time is on Times Square. So for me, it's nice to know, is it raining in New York City, by looking at 25-2. Do you get 50-1 and 50-2 is one question. You probably get 30 or 31-1, 2, and 3 also. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I could say not much interesting, you know, in looking at a lot of that. The only one you get that, you know, sometimes comes in handy, 7-3, is a weather channel, Dick, over.
Yeah, 7-3 is weather, 7-2 is a health-like thing, 7-1 is ordinary 7. Let's see what Joe's got to say. WHYYY, go ahead, Joe.
I know this comment isn't very much, but this is directed directly at you, and someday you'll surpass this without any problem at all. I have got digital television on every channel from 14 through 51 except channel 37. So my list is growing.
Now you're getting that reception, every single channel from 14 to 37, I think you said, or 47? Every single channel. You have found digital television by way of your scanner. On the average day, are those signals all strong enough to give you TV reception, Joe? Go ahead.
No, they are not. They're definitely not. This is quite an enhanced condition when I've got these type of receptions, especially channel 14. There's one of them up north, and this one I happen to catch down south. It was at the North Carolina-Virginia border.
So you're doing some real television DXing by way of your scanner receiver. You are running a preamp. I think your television area has a preamp built into it, so that's a preamp for the R7000, is that true?
To get the R7000, I'm talking about, I have copied digital channels on all of these frequencies on my television set, not my R7000.
Understand. And as winter comes by, and you get a little bit less band openings, I think you're going to see a little bit less of that. What's the highest number channel you've seen the television on, Joe?
51.
Okay. That means you don't get 55, where does 55 come from? Smithtown, I think it is. So you're not getting 55, you haven't aimed the antenna to the east. Go ahead.
Okay, let's get everything straightened out of here. I'm talking about RF channels. I'm not talking about their header information or what they call themselves. I'm talking about RF channels.
I understand. I should have made that clear. And 51 is the highest you've seen. Interesting. So 51 all the way down to 14. Wow. And in some places, 14 is allocated for other services. Isn't that true, Joe Grant?
Around here in the areas like Boston, channels 14 through like 17 are not there because they use them for public safety and EMS and other various different services. But in places like, off the beaten path, like around Virginia, North Carolina, they don't have T-band assignments down there so that you can put TV channels down there. The one particular day I was getting channels coming in from different directions. I got channels 19 from three different directions. I got one from North Carolina, one from Syracuse, and one from Boston.
By way of your rotator, is that true?
That would be correct.
So that rotator is a fun thing to do. The aerial that I saw on your chimney, is that the same one you're using now with the rotator? Or have you gone for an even greater fringe area and aerial? Go ahead, Joe.
What I have on my chimney is UHF communications antennas and a station master. What I have up on my tripod is a television antenna.
Yep, and would you consider that a fringe area and antenna? Is question number one. And have you seen any other human being in your town running a rooftop television aerial? Go ahead.
The answer to that would be no. I've seen other houses with TV antennas, but I have no idea if they're using them or not. Yes, that's a deep fringe antenna, and only because there's no channels really below channel 7 in this metropolitan area, which probably went about maybe 60, 70, 80 miles. I didn't get the bigger one, which is channels 2 through 6 and 7 through 13 in UHF. But I have copied channel 6 already from Philadelphia, even though the antenna is nowhere near resonant on that frequency, and I've got indications of channel 3. When I put my antenna at about 240 degrees, I can get something that's, the only thing in that direction is something from the extreme west end of Virginia.
How about that? Look at all the channels you're missing, Mel. You're going to be doing television DXing. Put one of these good antennas with a rotator on your tower, and you could be watching a lot more television. I know that's the last thing you need. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY, Mass. If there's something on worth watching, I would put the effort in. But other than PBS that runs once in a while, some interesting, you know, program like the NOVA programs with Science Now or whatever, most of it, forget it. I'm not interested in all those other programs they got out of situation comedies, which I never saw one that's funny. Or the lawyer program, the doctor program, the police chases, and all that stuff, and that stuff. It's just not my cup of tea. And neither the ex-file here says she likes she has a book. We go to the library and take out books. Still like the old-fashioned library books. It's a great deal. I love books, and even though I use the computer, the information on that, which is terrific and valuable there, definitely. I still, like I say, I have my choice. I'd rather have a book. All right, let's see. Should we try one more?
Comment.
Go ahead with comment.
Yeah, well, I'm paying for cable every month, so I'm really getting hosed. In fact, if I didn't have this Filipino channel package for my wife, I would have ditched it a long time ago, N2RDB.
Okay, N2RDB. But, over the air, you'd be able to get a number of Korean channels and Spanish channels, but you wouldn't be able to get the material you're interested in. Go ahead with one more, Mel. K2KEY.
H-U-L-A-W. You know, my brother, he's got that Fios, the fiber optic. He's got his computer and all that stuff, everything on it. And the television, he got that. He bought a new flat screen set, you know, 36-inch plasma thing and everything. And I sat there, and I went through the channels. Oh, my God, one after another, on and on and on. And I don't think we, the only thing we found interesting to watch, he and I, that afternoon, I said, ah, there's something. We watched the automobile auction, the antique car auction. And that said, oh, and he's interested. One other they also have on the same channel. This channel is, specializes in stuff with automobiles, auctions, and then they show you how they rebuild, you know, the antique cars, they refurbish them and all that stuff. That's it. The rest of the stuff, forget it. There's a lot of reruns, old stuff from the 50s, the 60s, the movies. From to me, I think for what he pays, it's ridiculous. That's my personal opinion. All right, here's one. Let me let it drop and we'll try this one. If the TV antennas are all horizontal. Oh, here's something with the TV. That's why I picked it out. Being we're fooled with TVs tonight. If the TV signals are all coming in vertically, possibly because of a vertical antenna at the transmitter site, would it be an advantage to be able to turn, or would it be possible to maybe improve your reception at times if you could also not only turn the antenna horizontally, I guess they meant, rotating it, but also turn the antenna so it's now a vertical that the beam sits vertically. That I never seen before. They turn the TV antenna into a vertical position, over.
I think he's onto something, Mel. Obvious by the fact that every 2-meter repeater you and I listen to, with rare exception, are purely vertical at the source. But in my particular house, for instance, when I listen on my handy talkie that's being used in the bathroom, I have to lay it horizontal on the table because that's the way the signal arrives. So, in other words, when the signal through multipath bounces all kinds of crazy ways, it arrives vertical, horizontally polarized in my bathroom. So, if your television aerial, even though television broadcast, to my knowledge, is purely horizontally polarized at the transmitter site, by the time it bounces off water towers, buildings, and whatever's, and gets to your particular town, on a certain occasion, it is possible that that signal arrives at some other polarization. And I, for one, am getting rather poor reception on what calls itself Channel 2, which I think is really Channel 33 for transmission, because I'm getting that channel simultaneously from the Empire State Building and from Hartford, Connecticut. I, for one, have to put up a rotator so I can favor one over the other so I don't get jammed and the picture disappears on me. But if I could also rotate the antenna in polarization, unless my antenna was super high up and had direct line of sight to Empire State Building, I'm reasonably sure that there are periods of time when some of the polarization on the antenna, because I put on a rotator for polarization, would make an improvement. No one's ever done it, but obvious by our experience on 2 meters, I'm sure there are times when that would help them, Mel. It's about time somebody investigates that. By the same token, you and I have been telling people for a long time, set up an antenna for both horizontal and vertical polarization when you're doing DX on HF, because some of those QSP fades are Faraday rotation of the ionosphere, creating some other polarization. I think he's onto something, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, now wait a minute. You saying to me that would be an advantage to put some kind of a rotator, like a AZEL type of rotator, and mount the TV antenna on it so that you can turn the whole TV antenna. And that, in other words, turn the TV antenna not only in azimuth, but it also swing it around into a more of a... In other words, I don't ever believe I've ever seen anything, or have they ever had some kind of an antenna that would be some kind of circular polarization. Has anything ever been done with, circular polarization with TV signals stick over?
Absolutely. Every 10 or 15 years, some other genius comes along and says, gee, we're getting ghosting effects and whatever in New York City because of the way the signals bounce between the buildings. Let's go to circular polarization on television broadcast and circular polarization on reception. every 15 years, somebody runs that experiment all over again. And it flops every single time. Circular polarization does not solve the problem. Because when a clockwise circular polarized signal takes a single bounce, it ends up counterclockwise circular polarization. And so the mixture of signals in the Marble Canyons of New York City, that's not a solution for ghosting. However, the real environment occasionally has a property called chirality. In other words, by the time that signal bounces from that water tower, the building across the street, gets sifted through the trees or whatever, some of that signal that arrives at your television reception aerial, at your house on top of your chimney, even though it started off as a pure horizontal broadcast signal at the Empire State Building, depending on your environment, it could arrive partially vertically polarized. So I'm not saying go to circular polarization. I'm saying that if you really want to have clear television DXing and have a lot of fun with it, I'd like to have a rotator that first rotates in azimuth. That's the big one. I don't think I have to rotate in elevation. I don't think that's required. But if I had the right kind of a setup that could also rotate the whole antenna about its boom so that I'm rotating linear polarization and I could slide from horizontal to vertical, I am convinced there are a small number of times that would give you a benefit, a stronger, cleaner signal with less interference from some other direction. I'm sure that would work, and I'm going to consider it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now that you bring it up, Dick, if you remember, you know, the television sets, of course, many people, I've told you what's going on here, with since this digital thing is a miserable pain here with some people here in the Brighton area. I don't even want to know what's going on no more. I just said I got away from it because it was such, it was almost a riot here when they switched over, literally, with the, lucky they were all old, mostly old people. But if you remember, they were all on indoor antennas, rabbit ear antennas, and none of the antennas, the rabbit ears were always, you know, most of them, the way they were made, these rabbit ear units, they were just two poles that would suck up. You could spread them apart a little bit, but you couldn't really go horizontal with them. And then they had a switch. I don't know what that switch did on there, but most of the time they just left them, you know, standing almost, you know, into like a V shape, straight up, and then just turn it. So it seemed like that was the optimum to receive a signal, Dick, in that position. Over.
Yeah, when I have two V's up in the air, Mel, and I put the plane of those V's broadside to the broadcast station, in that circumstance, even though you've got a lot of vertical metal, that antenna is primarily horizontally polarized. But if I now rotate the antenna in azimuth so that the plane of the antenna goes through the Empire State Building, now I'm listening to vertical. So some of those orientations of some of those monopoles coming out of that rabbit ear system sitting on top of the set, some of those orientations are definitely picking up vertical polarization, and some of those bounces of that signal into that particular home, in some circumstances, I think has a substantial amount of vertical energy to it. Mel, back to you, Mel.
So I guess would account for that. Some days you turned it this way, some days you turned it that way, until it finally broke off. But it was a good business selling those antennas for quite a while. But, yeah, that's what I was just envisioning, that at times there seems to be, you know, a difference, quite a difference in rotating it. So if you left the set say, on channel 2 the night before when you shut it off and it was in one position, the next day you came back and it was kind of crummy, it gave the antenna a little turn, and improved it. Like you say, you were just changing the plane, which basically was making the way the signal arrive more vertically or more horizontally. Okay, very good. So, I mean, there was something to it, the way they manipulated the antennas, because, well, even a lot of times, they were happy with it. It was a little ghosty, it was a little snowy. Very, very happy, the people. Now, Oh, I don't even want to know what's going on, Dick, because I think they made some kind of a, put some pressure on some of the cable companies to supply, oh yeah, I think Basic. I think they're supplying them with Basic cable, Dick, over.
So there's some kind of a rule that forces a cable company to do that? Or the person has to pick up the tariff? What do you think, Mel?
Minimal cost. I think they finally got it down. I think it's $4.95 or something a month or whatever. They finally came to some little agreement, and I don't know how it's worked out because, like I say, I don't want to get involved because you can get mobbed real quick. Don't say anything if you know anything about it. You're a ham radio operator. Good night. You're in trouble. Because there's going to be someone in the group who says, oh, yeah, I remember you. It was the way what you said to interfere at my television when I, you know, God. It starts all that stuff, and then before you know it, the old folks are going to hit you with their, over the head with their canes. So I don't go near that anymore. But they did, I understand they did. They did some kind of accommodation, Dick, over.
Interesting. Okay, we've run out of time, Mel. It's almost a bewitching hour. This was TechNet 1264 of the series. Mel and I will be back next week. Try to help out your friends and neighbors in the town of Bayville, Long Island. We have to slowly convince them that radio is their friend. It's not their enemy. It's something that gives them a lot of benefit. And they shouldn't try to keep removing the antennas from their town. 73, you all, be kind to each other, particularly people in Bayville, Long Island. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, very good. Again, thank you all for joining us, and we'll try to do it again next week. And for those who are celebrating the Jewish holiday, this today started the sundown and tomorrow, a very happy New Year to you, and we'll be looking forward to seeing everybody possibly. I think there's a ham fest coming up in a few weeks. Maybe we'll try to make it. Take care, everybody. 73. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
All right, let's talk about HWW. The guy looks like the jam simplex calling frequencies with his crappy repeater. Let's talk about that now.
You sound just like somebody who's checked into this TechNet several times.